Hello, I'm Ivan Berg, and this is my story. Part 8, 1954 to 1955, the Caribbean Cruises. To relieve the boredom of dry dock, I volunteered for a gunnery course run by the Royal Navy in London and the Thames Estuary Gunnery Range at Sheerness. In the event of war, I would be able to defend my ship by shooting at attacking enemy ships, submarines and aircraft. I duly reported to HMS Wellington, the ex-World War sloop moored on the Thames embankment, for lectures in gunnery and training in the use of loading the back end of a 4.7-inch gun kept in the hold. There were four of us on the course, and I was definitely the smallest and lightest. The instructor demonstrated opening the breech, loading a shell, shoving a bag of cordite and a primer behind it, and closing the breech, shouting out each movement as it was completed. Then it was our turn. We were each given numbers. Number four took the shell from the tube as it popped up, cradled it in his arms and passed it to number three, who then passed it to number two, which was me. And number two, cradling his arms as instructed to receive the shell, received the shell, staggered under the 50-pound weight, and dropped it. "Bloody lucky it wasn't live, number two. We'd all be dead," yelled the instructor. Then it was off to the Sheerness Naval Gunnery Range on the Thames Estuary for instruction and practice in anti-aircraft gunnery. This would entail shooting with live ammunition at a drogue being towed by an aircraft. We were going to shoot the 40mm Bofors and the 303 calibre Lewis anti-aircraft guns. Both guns were mounted on a raised concrete platform overlooking the estuary. The Bofors had a raised seat on a rotating platform and a crank to raise and lower the gun. It must have had an automatic feed for the shells because we didn't load it. We each had a turn to aim and fire at the drogue. The gun was fired with a foot pedal. The noise, close up, even with ear defenders, was painfully loud. "Number two!" yelled the instructor, pointing at me. I climbed into the seat, put on the ear defenders, and attempted to get the slow-moving drogue in the gun sight by turning a crank. The instructor tied a rope round my ankle and tapped me on the shoulder. I could shoot when ready. The drogue came across again. Brimful with excitement, I moved the gun until I caught it in the gun sight. I pressed my foot on the pedal and all hell let loose. I panicked. The gun was loosing off two rounds a second. The gun shook. I shook. The gun was rotating. The drogue was gone. And then it was over as my foot was yanked off the firing pedal by the instructor. I was told later by a grinning number one that the shells I was firing were getting a bit too close to the towing aircraft. Then it was time for the Lewis gun. This was mounted on a gimbal on a ship's rail. It had two round padded stocks that fitted into your shoulders and a strap that held you into them. Despite being a bit short for the job, I managed to move the gun up, down and round whilst looking through the gun sight as instructed. The drogue came round again. I got it into the sight and kept it there. The instructor tapped me on the shoulder. I pulled the trigger and began firing short bursts at the drogue, as instructed. I was on tiptoe, holding the gun down. As I started to shoot, the vibration shook my shoulders and my feet left the ground. I kept firing, and I could see the tracer shells getting lower and lower. Then I felt a weight on my shoulders. The gun came up, and my hand was pulled away from the trigger. I did complete the course with the proviso from the instructor to make sure I had some weight around my waist before shooting a Lewis gun. He suggested, I hope jokingly, a Lewis gun magazine. The Mauritania was stuck in dry dock through May and June due to a dock strike. There was also an unofficial walkout by seamen, which was ended very quickly after the government used the threat of military service to those serving in the Merchant Navy in lieu of it, like me. The job of writer on a Cunard liner in the 1950s was clerical. We organised signing on and signing off, allocated jobs and cabins, totted up overtime sheets, filled in United States crew landing permits for every catering crew member so they'd be allowed to go on shore in New York. No commies, homosexuals, or criminal records. It was a lot easier than the job on the Queen Elizabeth, no working out the sixth trip off for everyone. But it did mean no proper time off until we returned to the UK in May 1956. One morning, a few weeks before we sailed, I was alone in the office thinking about writing something on my brand new Letterer 22. When I was interrupted by a confident Cockney voice. "Here, mate, how do I go about getting a change?" He sprawled over the counter. I saw a shock of fair hair and a wide grin. The usual routine is to put a note into the second steward. "I thought you blokes did it." "Well, what's your article number?" The staff files were organised by article numbers allocated when signing on to ship's articles. I've forgotten it." "What's your name?" A card index was kept by name cross-referenced to the article numbers files. "Ix, Thomas, no, Tommy. Everyone calls me Tommy. Tommy Ix." "What did you sign on as?" He pulled a face. "Tourist waiter, worse luck." "And what do you want to change to? Gym or swimming pool attendant?" "Okay, I'll see what I can do." I scribbled his name on a pad and went back to my shiny new Letterer 22. "Oh, you blokes have got it dead easy, ain't you?" I looked up. He was still leaning on the counter. "I wouldn't mind a job in here. I can type." "Ta-ra then." Tommy got his change of job, and I didn't see him again until the ship sailed to start the series of 10 and 14-day Caribbean cruises out of New York. The Mauritania was a three-class ship, but only the first class and cabin class accommodation, restaurants and public rooms were in use for the cruises. Some of the tourist class cabins were made available for the crew, and I put myself and one of the lounge stewards in one of the larger two-berth cabins. I claimed the top bunk, as it was closest to the Punker louver ventilation outlet. This meant that in the stifling, humid heat of the Caribbean, I would be able to direct a stream of cool air over me. The Mauritania wasn't air-conditioned, and the cabins were in the bowels of the ship. Nevertheless, they were sheer luxury compared to the cruise quarters. I had a proper wardrobe and chest of drawers, and a writing desk. We had the use of a large bathroom with bath, shower and separate lavatory. The RMS Mauritania 2, to give her the proper name, had her maiden voyage on June 17, 1939 and was built as a half-size version of the Queen Elizabeth. She even looked like the Lizzie in profile. Cunard's first idea for the Maury was to use her on the London to New York run. She actually did a few trips between June and August 1939. She was the largest ship ever to dock in London in the King George V docks. Cunard's idea was to use her on the North Atlantic run when either of the Queens were in dry dock, usually 6 weeks at a time. But World War II intervened and the Maury became a troop ship, just like her much larger sisters. The 1950s Caribbean cruises, the Dollar Earners, sailed out of New York in the winter and joined the Queens on the Southampton-New York transatlantic run in the summer. This was the schedule from the winter of 1947. In 1955, when I joined, there were no summer runs because of the extra time spent in dry dock due to the dockers and seamen strikes. It was a long time ago, and I can't find any itineraries on the internet for the 1955-56 cruises. I think there were 10 altogether. We island hopped in a sort of loop. First stop was nearly always Nassau in the Bahamas, and the last, Havana in Cuba. In between were Antigua, Martinique, Haiti, St. Thomas, Barbados, Trinidad and Tobago, Curacao, Jamaica, and once or twice, Cristobal, Panama. We anchored off everywhere, except Cristobal, there being no port facilities large enough to handle the Mauritania. This was 1955, remember, and the cruising business was in its infancy. So we used the motorised ship's lifeboats as ship-to-shore tenders. I had a lifeboat certificate, so I was often the catering crew member looking after the passengers. My duties included counting them off and back on the ship, going with them in the lifeboat to the shore and helping them off and onto the jetty. Then there was jetty duty, which I tried to avoid, all day on a jetty under a hot sun, waiting for the lifeboats that ran back and forth on the half hour, and often without a drink, and in full whites uniform buttoned up to the neck. I never lost a passenger and made a few friends on the sometimes long trips to shore. The Caribbean cruises out of New York were very expensive, even in cabin class, so the clientele tended to be rather well off, mostly couples and singles looking for a shipboard romance. No children, as we didn't have the facilities. On the very first cruise, I met Jack and Edie Goldberg from Great Neck, Long Island. Jack was big in the rag trade with a showroom in the garment district in New York. He was very well connected. I once went to one of his cocktail parties at the Hotel Sheridan and met the broadcaster and gossip columnist Walter Winchell and film star Joan Crawford. I was introduced by Jack as a young novelist and playwright who was working on the Mauritania to round off his education. I was actually writing a play. It was called Pays to Advertise, and Jack said he would get it read by a friend of his who was an NBC vice president as soon as it was ready. The turnaround in New York at the end of a cruise was a relatively leisurely 3 days, and I wangled as much shore leave as I could to visit Jack and Edie in Great Neck. I went out on the Long Island Railroad from Grand Central Station. I would phone to say what time train I was catching, and was picked up at Great Neck Station by Jack or Edie in either of their cars. Edie had a yellow Buick convertible, Jack a very comfortable black saloon. I think it was a Lincoln Town Car. But my first love was the Buick, and Edie said she would let me drive it. I did, and almost put it in a ditch on an icy country road. The Goldbergs lived in a large chateau-style mansion in its own grounds. They had two small children, a boy of about 5 and a girl of 3, who were both enthralled by my English accent. I slept in one of the two big guest rooms and awoke to the smells of fresh coffee and bread and the sight of two small children standing quietly at my bedside, waiting for me to wake up and say something. Another time I went out to visit when a snowstorm hit New York, but the trains were running and Edie picked me up in the Lincoln as it had snow tyres fitted. By morning it was still snowing a blizzard and the trains had stopped running. We were snowed in. Almost a foot of snow had fallen in 24 hours. The roads were impassable and I was due back on board that afternoon. I phoned the ship and my boss, the chief writer, said not to worry. Sailing was being delayed by at least 24 hours because many of the passengers couldn't get to New York. So I had another very comfortable 24 hours in Great Neck. By the next morning, the snow had stopped, the snowploughs were out, clearing the roads, and by mid-afternoon, the trains were running again. If I couldn't organise enough time to visit Great Neck, I would call Arnie and Mimi, who lived in New Jersey Heights, overlooking the Hudson River. Their apartment had a great view of New York. Arnie was a dentist, and he was also a prestidigitator and a member of the New York chapter of the Magic Circle. He did astonishing things with packs of cards. I think he got a discount on the cruise because he could entertain the passengers. He was also a great dentist and fixed up one of my front teeth with the latest epoxy white filling. It lasted for 30 years. They had a Pontiac Starchief coupe that Arnie once let me drive all the way from Pier 90 through the Lincoln Tunnel to New Jersey. There was not very much time off to go ashore and explore the islands we visited. One of the jobs as a writer was to look after the ship's library, so I was a librarian for 4 hours a day, a wine waiter in cabin class for another 4 hours, and then a lounge steward in the evenings. The library was busy with passengers buying stamps for postcards to mail from the ship. And this, of course, is where I made money on the exchange rates. Not that much, maybe 20 to 30 pounds a cruise. I did better as a wine waiter and lounge steward, making £5 to £10 a day in tips and lounge drinks scams. If I wasn't on duty in the library, I would be on jetty or shuttle boat duty when we anchored off one of the islands. Most of the passengers went ashore on day excursions with packed lunches, so there was little activity in the restaurants. I did manage some time off to go ashore. I swam off Nassau's Paradise Beach, went skin diving with snorkel and flippers in Curacao, where I made friends with a very large fish, a grouper I called Sammy. I wrote a short story about Sammy later. I visited the Volcano Museum in Fort de France in Martinique and climbed to the top of a hill in St. Thomas to have a drink in the bar of a rather splendid hotel. I did another climb in the company of one of the ship's shop managers, whose name I've forgotten. She wore a rather full skirt and had a job holding it down on the very windy shuttle boat trip to the Nassau jetty. We climbed the very steep Queen's Staircase up to Fort Fincastle at the top of Bennett's Hill. Fort Fincastle, named after Viscount Fincastle, overlooks Nassau and Paradise Island. I went swimming in an American officer's pool in Cristobal, Panama. I walked around Bridgetown in Barbados, and I had tea on a hotel lawn in Kingston in Jamaica, where I listened to a really good steel drum band. I was one of the very few crew members who went ashore, so I was often alone. The exception was Havana in Cuba, where we anchored off for a two-night stay. It was promoted as either the Paris of the Caribbean or the Las Vegas, depending on whether you went to one of the nightclubs or casinos or brothels. Under President Batista, who had, incidentally, under a year left in power, Havana was an open city with the most infamous nightlife in the world. It was just a short hop by air from Florida, and Americans came in droves to spend their dollars in the nightclubs, casinos, and brothels. I went ashore with the lounge steward I shared a cabin with. He'd been to Havana many times and would make sure I didn't get mugged, too drunk, or, worst of all, kidnapped. I was a bit scornful about the kidnapping bit, but Ray insisted that it happened. We went ashore in one of the many water taxis that were a feature of Havana. Several of them waited by the gangway and charged 25 cents for the short trip. The lifeboat shuttles were free, of course, but they weren't instantly available like the water taxis. The other advantage was that they ran round the clock, so that we would be able to stagger back on board in the early hours. "Let's go to the Tropicana," said Ray. "It has one of the best floor shows." Several New York-style yellow cabs were waiting by the jetty, and we climbed into the first one. The driver looked a bit disappointed when he discovered we weren't American. The trip to the Tropicana took about 15 minutes, and we drove out of central Havana and along one magnificent boulevard with beautiful hacienda-style villas on either side, bordered with palms and flowering frangipani and bougainvillea. "Millionaire's Row," said Ray. "And that one," he said, pointing to a particularly large three-storied villa, "is the world's most expensive brothel." I didn't ask him, but I did wonder how he knew. Havana in 1955 advertised itself as the Paris of the Caribbean, but I'm sure that Paris was never like this. Havana was open to everything. The casinos, nightclubs, hotels and brothels were run by the mob, the American Mafia. They bought operating licenses from the Batista government and paid direct taxes to Batista and his corrupt officials, who were all pumping cash into Swiss bank accounts. Fidel Castro was in the hills, and Batista and his pals and the mob were running out of time.